Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So it's a privilege to introduce Professor John Cutaback. He's a professor of philosophy at Christendom College, where he's taught for 25 years. He lectures widely on topics including virtue, fatherhood, friendship, and household. And you can find his professional writings in a number of academic journals. And you might want to check out his book. You can find it on Amazon or probably in a good bookstore. It's titled True Friendship, Where Virtue Becomes Happiness, and it's published by Ignatius Press. On the Thomistic Institute podcast, you can find several of his talks. He's been a longtime contributor. Two I'd like to highlight. One, is masculinity toxic? A Thomistic perspective on marriage. And then also, preparing for a life in a household, a biblical and Thomistic perspective. So you can also find his thought on his own website, Lifecraft, which aims to assist people in freeing themselves from vain pursuits and craft a vibrant life rooted in relationship, reality, and presence. Professor Cutaback will be giving us our second conference for this retreat, titled Household as Natural Revelation of Masculinity and Femininity. Please welcome Professor John Cutaback.
Well, thank you very much, Father. I'm super excited to be here. I want to say, first of all, I'm being completely serious right now. This is a safe place. I want you to have complete freedom. Sometimes I get a little bit intense, and I might make some assertions that might seem a little bit, and you don't, I'm not trying to proclaim from the chair. I'm just sharing thoughts, principles, and so when it comes to the question answer, don't hesitate at all. I give you full freedom to say, well, I really don't see what you're saying there. I'm really struggling with that, and we can think about it together. So I just wanted to give you that freedom. First of all, again, thank you, Father Aeneas. It's great to be here. Thank you, Sister Eleanor, for a great, great foundation. I'm really, really excited, and I want to refer to that a couple of times. In fact, right now, if I might just try to kind of restate and reemphasize this incredibly beautiful notion of virtue. This comes out really beautifully when St. Thomas talks about friendship, where he talks about true friends love one another for who they are. And to try to bring out an understanding of who you really are, which is actually a very profound and challenging issue, the notion of virtue is central. And I don't want to get unduly sidetracked here, but it's really important to try to think about this. He asserts what to our ears will sound very strange. Becoming virtuous is most who you are. Already, Sister Eleanor was saying this, but it in play here is the Aristotelian notion of nature, such a profoundly important notion that you have. There's the human way of being. Any natural way of being is a way of being that only really becomes itself when it achieves the actualization, the perfection it is designed for. So to know that perfection is to know that thing. I'm going to use that principle a number of times, but who we are, most of all, in a sense, even now, although there's that that great tension of there's a lot of not yet in us. There's a lot of can be waiting to become what we are designed to be. This comes out very powerfully when you think about what it means to love someone. This is our age does not see this. There's a very fine line between just saying, well, I affirm you for who you are, versus I affirm you for who you are. You got to know the difference. You can't just affirm anything because by nature, we're designed and called to be something very specific. We're going to talk a bit about fatherhood, and we're so blessed that today's gospel is the prodigal son. I mean, this is, and thank you for your great sermon, Father, that a father, a true father, sees his child for who he is, which especially means he sees him for who he can be, because who he can be is his deepest identity. That is our deepest identity, that God has designed us to be this. This is an astounding thing. There is a version, Matthew Kelly's famous for using the best version of yourself, if you've heard that. There's a very important notion here. The best version of yourself is the real you. So you see how this notion of virtue is actually critical to being able to talk about what real love is, because real love has to be rooted in a vision of what that is. And so to talk about and try to understand the virtues is at the epicenter of trying to understand what it is to be human. This isn't just kind of, oh, it'd be nice to become virtuous. Again, I say, there is no real you except the virtuous you. In a sense, and again, this is very challenging, implied here is to the extent that we fall short of becoming virtuous, we are falling short of who we are. If in the end we do not become virtuous, we will not ever have become ourselves. Now, I'm leaving open the possibility of a perfection in the next life, hopefully through purgatory. But I mean, sometimes we have to face, life is very serious, that there's even the possibility of an unending state called hell, where you don't ever become yourself. In a sense, just naturally speaking, what else do we have to know about hell than that forever you would not be you? And you'd know that. So this virtue thing is, again, very serious and very beautiful. It's who we're designed to be. We have to understand it if we're truly going to love ourselves or to love other people. And then you have this unparalleled, jaw-dropping story of the prodigal father and the prodigal son. There's so much that might be said in terms of virtue, but just if you'll linger with me for a moment, the astounding immaturity, lack of character that we humans are capable of, that a child would look at his father and say, yeah, would you just kind of give me my inheritance? I mean, I speak to you as a father. Can you imagine your son looking at you and say, your inheritance, what you have to give to me is would you just kind of write the check? That's what he said. Just go ahead and write the check. Then I'll take what you have to give to me and I'm going to go. And I love, Father, how you have pointed out already what it says about a father that while his heart was rent, He gives it to him, as it were, and he lets him go. I want to say something. There's a great question asked last night by someone in the room who says, what do you do when you're struggling with hope? Well, I'd like to come back and say, well, I think right here, this parable, in a sense, is all you need. You're never going to be worse. None of us are ever going to be worse than the prodigal son. And what do we need to keep reminding ourselves? There's a father who's waiting. There's a Father who knows who we are better than we do. So I actually was so moved and loved this story so much. I memorized it to certain things to remind myself. And I just throw out to you, you might be interested to do that yourself. I will arise. I will arise and go to my Father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. And then remember what happens next. It's just stunning. Father hears. It almost as though he almost acts as though he didn't. The son didn't need to say that. The son did need to say that. The father heard the words. He doesn't say anything to the words. It's like, yes, you've said it. Now we're moving on. You are so forgiven. Somebody get my boy a ring. Somebody get my boy his shoes and put a cloak on this one. And where's the fatted calf? I mean, this may we never forget. May we never forget, as Father reminded us, there's a father who's walking the ramparts watching for us. One other quick thought for you. I happen to, I have someone close to me, very close to me, not long ago was going through Special Forces selection. And I was super kind of intent and involved. I was really into it and just like, okay, what's it going to be like beforehand? How can you find out it's hard to find out exactly what they're going to do in there beforehand and all that stuff. But what he said to me was, one of the things that has been told to me is, as long as you're in good shape, as in really good shape, the only thing that's going to sink you is if you give up. And they'll do everything they can to get you to give up. But if you don't give up, you're going to make it. Great analogy. Sometimes it feels like God is doing the selection. Where are they going to give up now? He's certainly not trying to get us to give up. But maybe it's in this. It's much better than Special Forces selection. He doesn't want anyone to drop. They actually want some people to drop out. Our Father doesn't want anyone to drop out, but he does need us to learn something. That we can do all things in him who strengthens us. And this selection process is, we're going to have to learn that. That we just keep going. We just keep choosing. That's one thing that by his grace is always in our power. And he's going to be super excited every time we keep choosing. Got to give you also just a quick quotation from C.S. Lewis on love. He refers to love here as he. Of all powers, he forgives most, but he condones least. He is pleased with little, but demands all. This is brilliance. I'm going to say it again, and you have to understand one of those lines rightly. Of all powers, he forgives most, but he condones least. He is pleased with little. What that means is little does please him. Doesn't mean he's hard to please. That means he's easy to please. He is pleased with little. Just give him a little. He's pleased. But he demands all. That says a lot because love understands that we're made for virtue. So I just close that loop. Love understands that we're made to be virtuous. So because we're made for so much, love is always going to forgive. It's going to forgive and forgive and forgive. It condones the least. It's never forgiving and saying, that wrong doesn't matter are two very different things. The astounding thing is the combination. That love sees the greatness that you're called to. Because of that greatness, is always willing to forgive you, but will never condone it, because condoning would be saying, I don't mind if you don't become you. That's what condoning would be. Oh, that's fine. Oh, this doesn't matter. No, love, a father can never say, this doesn't matter. He'll forgive, but he won't condone. Because of what virtue is. Because it's what we're made for. All right. Now, I'm going to get philosophical here. That was kind of preliminary, but in a sense, it's the whole show. In fact, may I even just, I want to suggest, if I may be so bold, kind of a question maybe we could take with us. I'm taking this as a retreat, like you all are. And I'm thinking, maybe in view of today's Gospels, a little gift, maybe the question, because I always think it's great to have a question when you're on a retreat. How is the Father calling us home to new life in Him? How is the Father calling us home to new life in Him? And how's that connected to the virtues? Because, of course, virtues all are about life. So I just want, that's the zone I'm getting in here, kind of in our retreat mode. I'll get a little philosophical here. Some of you might have been exposed to what are called Aristotle's four causes. I've already just kind of adverted to this. I'm going to get a little bit more specific. Two key of the four causes are called the formal cause and the final cause. And what sounds like a really nerdy abstract point right now is actually profoundly beautiful and has huge implications. And that's the intrinsic connection of the formal cause and the final cause. All right, so bear with me for a moment here. An intrinsic connection between the formal cause and the final cause. Formal cause can also become said as the what. The formal cause is what most of all makes a thing be what it is. The final cause is what we also call the end, the that for the sake of which. In some sense, you could also sometimes call that the goal. The key point here in the intrinsic connection, and this is the Aristotelian brilliance, to really understand the what, the final cause, you've got to understand the final cause. A way you can say that in English, just understand the what. You've got to understand the why. The what it's for the sake of, the ultimate why. Consider the piano. You could, do a mental imagination. You could study a piano for a long time, just kind of studying that thing right there. You had never been exposed to it. You didn't know what it was. Almost like picture, get a story where it's, you know, people that hadn't ever been exposed to piano, and they come upon this thing and they're studying it. Maybe they're carpenters they're really getting a sense of what it is by studying. They get a sense of how it's constructed. Maybe they even ended up plunking them. Okay, watch, sound comes out of there. Okay, they have a sense of what it is. You know, and then somebody sits down at it and starts to play, pick your pick, Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven. And all of a sudden they realized they had no idea what that was. Until now, they see the why of it. You never really know the what until you know the why. You can think you know the what. This applies to everything, not just artifacts. It applies to oak trees and apple trees. I get home, I would have been pruning my peach trees today, but this is more important. I'll prune my peach trees soon enough. But you don't know peach trees unless you know a flourishing peach tree that's producing sweet fruit. Now you know. Now you begin to know what a peach tree is. Ladies and gentlemen, what are masculinity and femininity? What are they? We've got to apply this principle here. We've got to know what they're for. There's a why in the sense of the final cause. People think a bit about, you notice here's this difference, here's that, and we proclaim about, well, that men tend to do this and women tend to do that. What's the why? What's the why? Well, let's talk about that a little bit. For starters, the natural plan for the complementarity of man and woman is the reason for masculinity and femininity. The natural plan for the complementarity of man and woman is the reason for the what. So we'll never understand what it is to be a man and what it is to be a woman unless we understand what, I mean, you want to, the plan of the designer in setting it up this way. There's a complementarity for the sake of a common flourishing. So let's try to say, just say outright out how we can express what the end is. That man and woman flourish together in their difference, where each learns from the other even while remaining different. And this no surprise, is a masterpiece. It's so amazing. One of the key things that if any difference, always remember this, any difference there is, it's like such a huge difference in what we're about to talk about, marriage, that when you discover the difference, if you don't bear in mind that there's a great reason for this, then the difference is going to drive you crazy. But if we know, if we have a sense of why, there's always a why, there's always a why, which will help us understand more the what of the difference. And we go back to this again and again. So if we miss or we deny the natural plan for the complementarity of men and women, then the reality of the differences will always escape us. Indeed, I dare say the difference will seem monstrous if we don't really understand what it's supposed to look like where they flourish together. And again, I want to say this greatness of to whatever extent we're going to find that there's excellences, in some sense, of virtue in which men will excel or excellences in which women will excel, that flow from natural differences. It's for the sake of complementarity, so there's a common good. It's going to be better because of this difference. But wait, there's more. It's also that each has exemplified something by the other, so that seeing it exemplified in the other, each can grow in that area too. That's absolutely essential to understanding this picture. And it's always a mistake in complementarity of man and woman to say, well, then we just... Well, they're going to take care of that. I don't have to worry about that because that's their strength. That's not the way it's supposed to be. The man who, to give a simple example in a kind of lug-headed way, says, well, I don't know how to, I'm not good with babies. I don't know what to do with that. Wrong answer. Learn from your wife. It's a very, very simple principle. Does that make the difference go away? No, it doesn't. So, in a plan you never could have made up, difference for complementarity. The difference always remains, that we learn from the difference. In that way, the difference becomes less far apart. We become more like one another, but still always being different. And ladies and gentlemen, where by God's plan is the natural, most obvious instance of this? It's in what's called marriage and a household. So I suggest a key to understanding our problem today. This is a little bracing. How few people come from intact, happy marriage and family situations, which is the natural context where a child goes, oh, wow, this masculinity and femininity thing is so good. That's where you see it. But if we're in a society that does not see what masculinity and femininity look like when they are flourishing, in complementarity, not seeing the why, we will struggle very much to understand the what. which is a very scary thing. And you have a situation where, gosh, just to look at, you know, at the difficulty of what we have before us, I don't need to go into the dearth of examples that people have in order to be able to come to some comprehension of this. But we're so blessed in our tradition to be able to speak about this in a rich way, even amidst much personal hurt. And I'll come back and say a little bit more about the personal hurt thing shortly. So it's just three more brief things that I want to do. In view of what I just said, I want to take a very brief look at household, just so we have some sense of that amazing natural reality wherein we're going to see masculinity and femininity. Then draw a couple conclusions quickly about masculinity and femininity from that household situation. Then just say a couple of words then about why it makes sense to speak of, in what sense or not, masculine and feminine virtues. So Father, just so I'm our timing is, and I'm leaving time for questions.
So 30 minutes for talking questions.
Gotcha. No problem. Good. All right. Silly me. Okay. I didn't give you the handout. And here it is. I've never been told anybody, Father's right now saying, well, John, if you told me you had a handout, I would have reminded you. Don't put tobacco in there and roll it into a cigarette just yet. All right, let's get through the day, because you need this for your second lecture also. We'll smoke them together tonight. We'll talk about that. All right. Because I got this special paper. All right, just kidding. All right, so we're going to look, first of all, at a few quotations about household here. This is going to be the three-minute whirlwind. What does Aristotle mean by a household? Quotation number one, household is the association established by nature for the supply of men's everyday wants. By the way, in our quotations, I mean, very often it's the language of men, of course, means human. When we come to some things where men means man in the sense of male, we'll make that clear. Household association established by nature for the supply of men's everyday wants. So just household is natural. There's a natural plan. What is it? It's a small community. It's life on a human scale. It's the ultimate sense of life on a human scale. You don't live life on a human scale with 300 people. You live life on a human scale with a small number of people. And it's designed especially to take care of, this is Aristotle's great insight, everyday needs. So the way we keep thinking about what a household is what do human beings need every day? That's the kind of charter of a household, is what do we see by nature that human beings need every day? And I just say this, is again, you're going to get sick of my saying it to you. The plan is always better than we've yet realized. The plan is always better than we've yet realized. I want to encourage you to Socrates says it's important to know what we don't know. There's so much to discover about what marriage, family, household can be by God's natural plan. The richness of the interconnection between the spiritual and the bodily. Quick example, that we need to eat several times a day. Household is where that's done. But it's not just for your bodily needs. It turns out that attending to your bodily needs is the best natural context to attend to your emotional needs and your spiritual needs. So you have the importance in a household of eating together, and you eat together several times in a day, and you work together. The rich traditional notion of a household was this place of profound human community, interconnection, presence, formation. It's a plan, it's a natural plan for helping people become who they should be. Number two, therefore, it's clear that the care of the household concerns human beings more than material property. You think, oh, that's a throwaway line. No, that's not a throwaway line, because indeed, lo and behold, Aristotle saw it because it was happening in his time too. He knew we'd take, as it were, his word, economics, which means the law of the household, and we'd reduce it to being about material exchanges. This has always been a temptation of man, humans, to as it were, go for the lower and be get absorbed in material wealth and forget persons. And if that sounds very far away, again, I'm going to be a little challenging to you here. How many parents have made this very concrete mistake? Song Cats in the Cradle, is that just like way too far in the past for you all? Just raise your hand if you know the song Cats in the Cradle. All right, bottom line, it's devastating and it's powerful. The little boy saying, hey, Dad, you got time to come play ball with me? No, sorry, son, I'm actually really busy. I'm really busy. Why? Because he's got a profession, right? He's really busy. And that goes on and that goes on. And then one day, Dad's getting older and he says, hey, son, you're going to come by and visit? And he goes, sorry, Dad, I'm really busy. It's devastating. And how many people end up having the experience of, what was I thinking? In the hierarchy of people versus stuff. All right, so that's why Aristotle said that household is the place where naturally, most of all, we should see the true priority of persons. Third quotation, that the end or goal of domestic prudence. This is a virtue we're going to come back and talk about, and talk about how there's a difference in how men and women do it. But it's at the center of marriage. It's a Thomistic jewel. It's a kind of prudence. And as all true prudences, it's about the good life in general, which means this is very different from some art that has to do with just making stuff. This prudence, domestic prudence, is a virtue of crafting the good life in the home. Prudence is always a know-how of crafting a good life. Individual prudence is a know-how of crafting a good life in your own life. Domestic prudence is a virtue of crafting the good life in the home that a husband and wife develop together. And it shows something very important about this little community, that this virtue that governs it is a virtue that is about, as it were, the whole of life. So parents have a responsibility for virtue, for helping one another, their children, anyone they have responsibility for, anyone in their household. Households are about virtue. Domestic prudence is about putting order into the life of the home so that people become themselves, which means they become virtuous. And that's the shared life of a husband and a wife, which is more than enough to unite you for a lifetime and beyond. All right, that's the foundation then for starting to get into the difference between man and woman, because the needs of a household demand it. So I'm in number four here. This is Aristotle on what he calls the friendship of man and woman. And interestingly, Aristotle wouldn't see any significant friendship between a man and a woman other than in marriage. Not that there can't be any, but that's where, obviously, the truly significant one. The union of male and female among men occurs not only for the procreation of children, but also for the functions needed in human living. These functions, it is immediately apparent, are so divided between man and woman that some are proper to the husband and others to the wife. Right along with that, number five, obviously then conjugal friendship among men not only is natural as among other animals, where it is directed to the work of nature and in the generation, but also domestic is directed to a sufficiency for family life. All right, so bottom line, the context then more specifically to start to understand masculinity and femininity through a kind of a Thomistic lens here is what is needed by nature in that community. And it's in the particular, sorry, the particularly important angle there is through the eyes of the children. And it sounds simple, but unending fodder for reflection. Children need a mother. Children need a father. This is always the most obvious angle of insight into the difference between man and woman. You go to household, which is where humans live a daily life. And in a sense, it's always about the children. What do they need? That's the great angle. All right, so then a little bit about masculinity and femininity. I'm using a man who darkened these halls once upon a time many years ago, named Timothy Fortin. His dissertation is called Fatherhood and the Perfection of Masculine Identity. And I give you a few definitions here in number 7 on your handout. What's maleness? It's a human accidental form. We don't have time. Accidental doesn't mean whoops. Accidental just means it's not what we call the substantial form. It's not the soul. It's quite intentional. And if we need to, we'll talk about that in the Q&A. But the point there we need to see is male and female does not make an essential difference between them. We're the same species. But that's why it's called an accidental form. It's given unity by its ordering to generation of the human form according to the male mode. Femaleness, jumping out, a human accidental form, it's given unity by its ordering to generation of the human form. So it's this human life is about generosity.
I'm just going to throw this word on the board here. I should just write something down. This word, so many great words, generosity. All right. That's embarrassing. How the heck do you spell it? Generosity. All right. There we go. That'll keep you humble. All right. The etymology of generosity, it has this great two-partness to it. Generous in the sense of being other-centered, giving of yourself, and generous in the sense of generating, procreative. We can take that in a broad sense. Human life is always about generosity. The good is diffusive of itself. And so this is particularly going to come out in the household. And being man and woman is always intrinsically ordered towards being generous. Masculine and femininity is a set of characteristics that each in their own way are ordered towards being generous. And so you have definition of fatherhood and motherhood there. And the key thing here is how he gives the male mode versus the female mode. Fatherhood, a generative agency as regards the human good. It just means fatherhood is about bringing about good human life. Which agency is the completion of maleness? Being a man is always ordered towards being a father. Being a woman is always ordered towards some kind of motherhood. And so being generative, but what mode? The key terms here, active, initiating, outward. Whereas with motherhood, more receptive and inward. Now the issue is going to be in the details, but what is the great broader formal way of saying the difference between men, masculinity and femininity? Again, these words at their level of generality, they can be misinterpreted. And it also, remember, this is not a difference as though what especially characterizes the one is not also found in the other. It is also found in the other. And again, we said there to bring out in the other that aspect. But nonetheless, by nature, there's that kind of difference. All right. I already said this, but I'm going to just quickly say it again. We have to understand when it comes to talking about masculine and feminine virtues. So we have to have some understanding of masculinity and femininity. And we need to recognize the age that we live in.
I'm going to say something that's kind of bracing right now. We all have suffering. We all have hurt. And I think we live in an age that, again, I say, I think particularly finds it difficult to think clearly about masculinity and femininity. Because it is so beautiful, so central in life, so important, that when there's been suffering in our life as regards these things, it makes it very hard for us to think clearly about it. May I give a simple example? When you have children that have suffered from a lack of either one, appropriate masculine attention, appropriate motherly attention, it I'm not trying to play psychologist, this is just kind of obvious. It has a very significant effect upon us. And it makes it very difficult to think clearly. One way one might say this is you tend to have a lot of children who not only are they having trouble thinking about it, in their hurt, it often turns to an anger and even a kind of hatred. There's a lot of hatred of masculinity out there. Main reason, because masculinity hasn't been doing what real masculinity it is. And so it comes under hatred. Same thing on the mother. So we have the very toxic situation of this. You have a lot of woman man haters. You have a lot of men women haters. And in a sense, and they kind of it all goes together. I'm not trying to play psychologist. I'm just saying this. We all have to be very aware of this in ourselves, in the others that we deal with, that there's a lot of suffering involved. And who knows even what might be coming out in our own thoughts and hearts right now when we're referring kind of in the abstract, oh, this great household and what the children need. Well, I just want to say, we're may I give you Malachi 4:2? But for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness shall rise with healing in its wings. You shall go forth leaping like calves from the stall. There's healing in the Lord. A couple of things on masculine and feminine virtues, and I'm going to finish in 3 minutes, and we'll have 13 minutes for questions. There are no virtues that pertain only to men or virtues that pertain only to women, I think. Now, if by the end of the day we find out something else, well, I'll change that. But I think it's fundamentally, and I think this is where sister was. There's no virtues in their kind that pertain only to men or virtues that pertain. That's very important for us to recognize. There are real differences in how people form and exercise those virtues that we have in common. One obvious way of seeing this is to remember the Aristotle's definition of moral virtue, it says it observes a mean, but that mean has to be in some sense relative, not as though there's no objectivity to it, but in some sense relative to the person. It gives this famous example of a huge wrestler. It eats a different amount of food, and that's temperate than someone who is a small person. All right, and so then we can just say, given the general differences between men and women, beginning just biologically, very often that will make a difference of what the mean of the virtue is. Quick example, courage in the face of an attacker looks different for a man and a woman, generally, right? What the courageous person will do, kind of what the mean is here in action, is going to look different. So already just, while the virtue is fundamentally the same kind, there's room for it to be exercised differently. One further point, though, and we'll have occasion to talk about this more, especially in the second lecture. It can be the case that there's a difference of virtue according to the role one has in the community. And the main example that we'll talk about later, first of all, political prudence. There's a difference. Some people exercise it as a regnative prudence that the people do not engage in. Oh, it's there in them in a different kind of way. So given you different roles in society, there's a different way of exercising the virtue that's called political prudence.
In St. Thomas and Aristotle's mind, this is a delicate matter, and I'm going to end on it. We can talk about it more particularly this afternoon. You can bring it up now. We can start to talk about it a little bit. The virtue I mentioned called domestic prudence. St. Thomas and Aristotle don't get everything right on their understanding of man and woman, I don't think. But there's a lot that we can learn from them, and I think they're right on this. That there's a kind of first authority by a natural plan that a man has in the marriage and household context. I think that's also biblical. Given that difference of a first authority of a man in the marriage and household context, then there is a different way, though I noted that they share the growth in domestic prudence, as his having a first authority, his exercise of it has an intrinsic difference from hers. It's still a virtue that they share and they grow in together, but it ultimately, if having first authority and the biblical notion of headship has real meaning, then it must make a difference in how that virtue is exercised. I'm going to talk more about some other areas of virtues, I think, then, because I'm going to focus on men in my final talk, my next talk, and we'll bring out some more things there. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.